It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. About two decades after American colonialists protested a tax on tea leading to a revolution, some Pennsylvanians revolted against their fledgling national government, specifically an excise tax on whiskey. The Whiskey Rebellion ended 225 years ago, and there's a festival in Washington, Pennsylvania, ready to celebrate it all. Tripp Klein is the Whiskey Rebellion Festival co-chair. Tripp, welcome to the Confluence.
Thanks, Kevin. I'm glad to be here.
So, Tripp, I want to start off a little history lesson, if you don't mind. Why did Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton want to tax whiskey?
Well, they needed to raise funds to actually pay for the revolution that you just mentioned. There was a need to raise funds for the new federal government, and Alexander Hamilton determined that a tax on whiskey, essentially the first sin tax, if you will, was a way to do that. And so he placed a tax across distilled spirits in the United States. It was the first excise tax on American products in history.
How big was the whiskey distilling business in southwestern Pennsylvania at the time?
Well, actually, it was very large. It was a regular activity of the farmers of the area. They used whiskey as a barter. They traded. One would say, I'll give you a gallon of whiskey if you help me build my barn, that kind of thing. So it was a regular form of currency on the frontier in western Pennsylvania.
Was it rye-based?
Absolutely. Rye grew very well in western Pennsylvania. It was a grain that could be easily converted to whiskey. So it just made a lot of sense that the farmers would use that out here.
So how did they rebel?
Oh, well, actually, when they first passed the tax in 1791, there was an interest. There was obviously a disagreement about what it would do to the farmers of western Pennsylvania. So they met in public. They raised liberty poles across western Pennsylvania to express their discontent for the whiskey tax. Mm-hmm. They attacked tax collectors. They tarred and feathered tax collectors. They burnt the homes of the excise tax collectors. So it did, in the summer of 1794, turn violent because of the lack of action that the farmer rebels saw that coming from the federal government.
And violence begot a military, or at least a militia, response.
Well, President Washington knew that he couldn't allow the violence to stand in the western counties of Pennsylvania. But he wasn't sure exactly how to suppress it initially. So for nearly 4 years, the farmers in western Pennsylvania were able to resist the tax. And finally, George Washington, at the urging of Alexander Hamilton, decided to to use the Militia Act and raise forces to come west to western Pennsylvania to put down the rebellion.
Washington actually accompanied the militia for a while?
Oh, absolutely. And that's one of the...
A sitting president?
Yes, yes. And the only time a sitting president has ever led troops in the field. It's a unique event in all of American history. George Washington reviewed the troops in Carlisle and then marched west as far as Bedford, Pennsylvania, and stayed at the Espy House in Bedford as his headquarters. It wasn't until there that he decided to send Alexander Hamilton and Harry Lighthorse Lee, the Revolutionary War general, west to suppress the rebellion in the late summer and fall of 1794.
A relative of that Lee would wind up in Pennsylvania several decades later.
Yeah, his son, actually, Robert E. Lee, led the Battle of Gettysburg. Of course, was another test of the American government, you might say.
Well, speaking of tests of the American government, there were a lot of firsts involved when our country was still very young and even divided over a strong central government versus states' rights. So how big of a challenge was this to the executive authority?
Well, it was absolutely the largest challenge to the young federal government of George Washington. There was a lot of concern about the power of government, particularly after the Revolutionary War. We were fighting against a tyrannical government, if you will, in King George. And many of the farmers who came to Western Pennsylvania fought in the Revolution. So they saw the same thing happening, unjust taxes, lack of support from their government. And so it was not, it was the spark that lit the rebellion was the whiskey tax. But there were many other complaints that went unanswered by the government in Philadelphia.
So give us an idea. How many rebels and how many militia were headed this way?
Well, you know, there's a lot of talk about that. There was the march on Pittsburgh in the summer of 1794, which between 5,000 and 7,000 rebels came to Pittsburgh to protest the tax. And one of the leaders of the rebellion, David Bradford, whose home is in Washington, Pennsylvania, led that march on Pittsburgh and basically kept it peaceful. A barn was burnt down, but other than that, there was no real violence on that march. But that was one of the culminating activities that really caused President Washington to say, we have to stop this. So there's many, many other cases. The burning of the Neville House in outside of Pittsburgh and Bridgeville, where that's really the first two casualties of the rebellion occurred. Young Oliver Miller was killed at the battle, what they call Bower Hill. And James Fitzpatrick was also killed during that encounter.
Was there any clash, though, between the militia and the rebels, or did the rebels sort of disband when they got wind of, saw, you know, that they were really outnumbered?
Well, I think that's the real end of the rebellion was sort of went out with a whimper, if you will. When the rebels caught word that 13,000 troops, the largest army that George Washington had ever led, he never had an army that large during the Revolution, was in Bedford and ready to march across the Alleghenies here into western Pennsylvania, they dispersed into the countryside, and the rebellion basically failed then.
But some of those leaders had to answer for what they did?
Oh, yeah. As we said, Harry Lighthorse Lee and Alexander Hamilton came across the mountains, arrested a number of protesters in western Pennsylvania, took them back to Philadelphia where they were tried for treason.
So
there were several locals that were tried for treason. It turns out that they were all pardoned by George Washington.
Another first,
the first use of presidential pardon powers. The only one not pardoned during under George Washington was David Bradford, who had fled the rebellion and ended up settling in what is now Louisiana. But he was the only one not pardoned. It wasn't until the Adams administration that David Bradford was pardoned for his actions during the rebellion.
And briefly, one of those convicted, his name lives on today?
Philip Weigel Wiggle, you may be familiar with Wiggle Whiskey here in the Strip District. One of the interesting things about the history is how we can take the history and use it to market products today, and Wiggle Whiskey's doing a great job with that.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Our guest is Tripp Klein. He's co-chair of this weekend's Whiskey Rebellion Festival, kicking off Thursday in Washington County. So, Tripp, why is it important to celebrate an uprising over whiskey?
Well, you know, it's interesting is you wonder why anybody would celebrate, you know, a rebellion against our own government. And I think the importance is the impact it had on American history. And that's what we're really celebrating. The Whiskey Rebellion was the first true test of the young federal government. And it really established a strong federal government, an ability to tax and an ability to enforce the taxes and enforce the laws of the federal government. So that was a first.
Tours and battle reenactments are always popular. Thinking about, of course, our Eastern neighbors honoring Civil War soldiers at Gettysburg. Briefly, what will be reenacted at the Rebellion Festival this weekend?
Well, one of the highlights of the festival is our street theater performances. All day on Saturday, we have historic reenactments of the act activities that happened during the rebellion. And so we do a big educational opportunity to come down in a fun way and interact with reenactors and actors who portray people like Hamilton and like John Lennox and all of the different characters who were part, historical characters who were part of the rebellion.
Okay. Is the festival an economic development tool for Washington County, the region?
Absolutely. We've always seen it. This is the 10th anniversary of the festival, and we've always seen it as a tool. We are seeing a great growth of craft spirits distillers coming into our area. Two have opened up recently in downtown Washington, and so we're excited about that. Other businesses are opening up because of the history that is around the Whiskey Rebellion.
And you can't have a Whiskey Rebellion festival without whiskey, so do I assume there'll be some sampling?
Absolutely. As the aforementioned Wiggle Whiskey will be there, as will Liberty Pole, one of our locals, and Red Pump Distillery. But this year we've got a new thing. We've got 15 statewide craft distillers are coming in for a tasting tour that we'll have on Saturday. And you can find out about that on our website at WhiskeyRebellionFestival.com and sign up for the tasting tour of great whiskeys.
And we'll link to that on our website as well. Less than a minute left, Tripp. So what are you most looking forward to?
I love the history part. I love the street theater and everything that goes on. We have great music, children's activities, everything that you'd want to do, spend a day on Saturday. We have blues music on Friday. Come down for that concert. So just check it out. It's a lot of fun.
Tripp Klein is the co-chair of the annual Whiskey Rebellion Festival Thursday through Sunday in Washington County to mark the 225th anniversary of the end of the Whiskey Rebellion, an important challenge to our new democracy. Thanks, Tripp.
Thanks, Kevin.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I often wonder what the pioneers of rock and roll would think about the music that they inspired. Would Chuck Berry be into shoegaze? Would Buddy Holly go to see his favorite emo bands? Would Carl Perkins make the best nu metal album you ever heard? It's hard to say, but one thing I know for sure is that Bill Haley and his Comets made real rock and roll history on this day in 1955 when their song Rock Around the Clock became the first rock and roll number one. It was released initially as the B-side of 13 Women, but it took off in a very big way after being included in the film Blackboard Jungle. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Since Mayor Bill Peduto took office in 2014, roughly 162 parking spaces have become bike lanes. And as Pittsburgh Post-Gazette reporter Ashley Murray found, the revenue lost from those city parking spaces hasn't amounted to too much. Ashley joins us in studio now. Welcome back to the show, Ashley.
Thank you, Kevin. How are you?
I am well. Your story looks at money spent on infrastructure and how that compares to lost revenue. So what's the verdict? How much is the nearly 14 miles of shared and protected bike lanes built since Peduto came into office costing the city?
So since Mayor Peduto took office, just a few hundred thousand dollars each capital budget was devoted to bike lane infrastructure. And when you take that into consideration of the entire capital budget, it's actually a small amount. And then what I did was look at, you know, other metrics to measure this. You know, lost parking. Was there any parking revenue for the city lost? It turns out it's just a drop in the bucket.
So bike infrastructure is now under the umbrella of the city's Complete Streets initiative. That wasn't always the case. How is Complete Streets affecting city infrastructure in general?
So Mayor Peduto issued an executive order in 2015 to say that any infrastructure on public streets is now going to be in this Complete Streets model. And then that was approved by City Council in, I believe, 2016.
Right.
Any road that's going to have a significant amount of construction, the city is now saying it has to be safe for pedestrians and ideally safe for cyclists as well as cars. So it's taking that car-centric approach, you know, and that mindset out of the project and you know, ideally wanting it to be for all people.
So 162 lost spaces. How much lost revenue from this?
Just over $1 million.
Okay.
Yeah.
What helped offset or hold down the lost revenue, would you say?
The parking authority's revenue has just been increasing, and really that has to do with something that was before Mayor Peduto was in office as mayor. He was still on city council. And that was the switch from coin meters to those digital meters that you can now use your credit card or debit card, or now there's like a phone app. So the parking revenue has actually just increased since 2012 when those were installed.
So how does the city decide where it wants to put bike lanes? Are they trying to connect specific neighborhoods, specific communities?
Yeah, so bike advocates, they say, hey, this is ridiculous. These bike lanes are not connected. It's not intuitive to get anywhere around the city on a bike in a continuous fashion in a safe manner. So now there's been a 2-year process of creating a bike master plan, and Karina Ricks said that it's likely to get released to the public by the fall, by the end of the year at the latest. And so basically, the city says it's been meeting with stakeholders, including business owners who are, you know, concerned about losing parking, and bike advocates who want to connect these lanes in a safe manner.
So these meetings with stakeholders, that should give us sort of a sense of where the city wants to add bike lanes, and if so, where?
The one example that Mayor Peduto did bring up when I interviewed him was Penn Avenue, and he said, you know, there are calls to extend the bike lane down Penn Avenue, because there is a protected bike lane that goes from, I believe, 6th to 16th Street
right
on Penn Avenue. It stops before the main strip district, business district on Penn Avenue. And so there are business owners there who are very concerned, not just with a bike lane, but there's a whole context of all the development that's happening. And they just believe that they're getting squeezed out, like parking is getting squeezed out. And so Mayor Peduto said, you know, some people want to extend the bike lane on Penn Avenue, but, you know, I have to take into consideration these businesses that have been there for 100 years. You know, Mayor Peduto did mention that it's a possibility that bikes could be routed to a riverfront trail or to Liberty Avenue. The city is embarking on a 5-year complete streets reconstruction project of Liberty Avenue.
Ashley Murray is the City Hall reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Ashley, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The discussion around climate change often focuses on increasing renewable energy. But if the world is to achieve the 2015 Paris climate goals and avoid the worst effects of global warming, people also need to start using energy more efficiently. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick takes a look at a new building that aims to be a model for the future.
During the summer at Millersville University, things quiet down. It's a good time for prospective students and their parents to check out the campus in Lancaster County.
We're here for a tour.
Okay, and the name of the student?
Kylie.
The first stop on the tour is a modern, light-filled building with flags from more than a dozen countries hanging from the ceiling, representing the school's international students.
You are currently in the newest building at Millersville, so this is the Lombardo Welcome Center.
The $10 million structure is the first building in Pennsylvania to be certified as a zero-energy building by the International Living Future Institute. It's a Seattle-based organization that promotes sustainable construction.
Net zero means that it produces as much energy as it consumes during a year.
That's Kathy Schreiber, a professor who teaches sustainability at Millersville. She says the building actually does better than net zero. During its first year of operation, it generated 75% more energy than it consumed. That's thanks to more than 500 solar panels on the roof, plus a ground-mounted solar array that tracks the sun's path across the sky each day, and 20 geothermal wells outside on the lawn. They don't look like much on the surface, but they help keep the building warm in the winter and cool in the summer.
It's a little circular device. It's just a small cement circle on the ground with a metal circle in the middle, and the well goes down about 400 feet into the ground.
She said the temperature down there is around 54 degrees Fahrenheit year-round.
So what we can do is we have an antifreeze that goes down, and it takes heat from the building, and it puts it in the ground during the summertime, and that antifreeze then comes up cool, and that coolness helps to keep the building cool.
It works the same way in reverse during the winter. Back inside the atrium of the building, at first glance, the soaring glass walls look similar to those in many modern buildings, but move in a little bit closer and you can see small gray dots scattered on the glass. Those help block sunlight, another way to conserve energy on a hot summer day. It's all part of Millersville's goal to be carbon neutral by 2040. And while buildings like this one are still relatively rare, they can serve as an example of why energy efficiency matters. That's according to Julian Boggs. He's with the Keystone Energy Efficiency Alliance. He says it can be a bit complicated to think about how to use energy efficiency to meet climate goals.
And in fact, that's a little bit counterintuitive, the idea that energy efficiency is itself an energy resource and that we can meet our energy demand not by building a wind farm or a solar panel or a nuclear power plant or a gas power plant, but by reducing our demand.
Reducing demand ultimately means using fewer resources and creating fewer harmful emissions. Boggs spends a lot of time in Harrisburg talking with lawmakers. He says the basic concept of not wasting energy is something both parties can agree on.
I have never run into a legislator who says, I do not think we should be more energy efficient, or I do not support energy efficiency.
Boggs says there have been some recent successes in Pennsylvania. For example, a year ago, the legislature approved and Governor Tom Wolf signed a new law known as Commercial Property Assessed Clean Energy. It's a voluntary program local governments can opt into. It helps commercial property owners finance the often expensive upfront costs of energy efficiency upgrades, like better insulation, new hot water heaters, or solar panels. And Boggs says the state took another leap forward last year when it updated what's known as the International Energy Conservation Code standards, a 30% energy efficiency improvement over the previous version of the code.
So new construction, if those new construction buildings are up to code, are significantly more energy efficient than new construction that was up to code a few years before.
In January, Governor Wolf signed an executive order directing state agencies to reduce their energy consumption by 3% each year, with the goal of hitting a 21% reduction in 6 years.
When you're looking at the state government, at least, reducing energy use 21% by 2025 is enormous.
He says even though energy efficiency can often be more complex than screwing in a few LED light bulbs, policymakers can help smooth the way by creating new energy-saving programs and financing options.
I think it's important that we create the incentives and space for the energy companies, energy efficiency service providers, and utilities to make that easy and available for everyone.
Back at Millersville, Dylan Rohr is getting ready to show off the energy-efficient features of the new Welcome Center for the next tour coming in. Rohr recently graduated with a degree in psychology and says sustainability is not something he used to think about much, but walking around in here has given him a new appreciation for the world's environmental challenges and solutions.
Yeah, I think it's something that not just my generation, but future generations will definitely have to be facing.
He says the new building has become one of his favorite spots on campus. Marie Cusick, State Impact Pennsylvania, Lancaster County.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Kenya has been singing the songs of her native Brazil in Pittsburgh for nearly three decades. She's well established in our city's jazz community and provides a bit of home to other Brazilians living here. She also has been providing opportunities for other musical artists from Brazil to perform for Pittsburgh audiences in an intimate setting, which she calls Club Catupiry. These are house concerts in her home where musicians and audiences interact in an up-close concert experience. Kenya spoke with 90.5 WESA's Bob Studebaker.
Kenya, thanks for coming in and hanging around with me for a while.
It's always my pleasure, Bob.
I'd like to ask you a little bit about the house concert you have coming up with Marcos Ariel, mm-hmm. which is a really interesting concept. But I'd like to ask you some general questions first, just about what it's like to be performing the music of Brazil in a city so far away from Brazil.
It's always lovely to be able to do that. You know, it's great to share, you know, the love that I have for the music and the beauty of the music with audiences. It's quite interesting here in Pittsburgh as, you know, it's not exactly very popular, you know. However, once we are bunched up with the jazz audience, then we are okay. So it's really nice. I have had a lot of really great reception ever since I moved here. You know, in the beginning it was kind of a little rough spot, but it's been 28 years, Bob.
One thing I've noticed at your performances, there are very often a fair number of people who are also natives of Brazil.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about the Brazilian community in Pittsburgh.
Well, it's an ever-growing community, as is the Latino community in general, you know. But every once in a while when we have some cultural events, you see all these people, it's like, where did you come from? Where do you live? And they have been living here for a long time. So it's a very, very interesting community because it's not very centralized. You know, okay.
There's not a neighborhood.
There's not like a neighborhood, and there's not a Brazilian supermarket per se.
Gotcha.
You know, I mean, there is the Green Forest, the Brazilian restaurant, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
But it seems to me like they are not really frequented by mostly Brazilians either. You know, it's mostly Americans, which is very, very interesting.
I've been there a lot.
Yeah, I know. I sang there a lot and I loved it.
Well, let's talk a little bit then about the house concert that you're having.
Okay.
And you're bringing in a pianist and a composer
mm-hmm.
and a multi-talented performer who actually is known in many parts of the world.
Yes.
But he's new to Pittsburgh.
So he is very new.
Tell me a little bit about Marcos Ariel.
Yeah, Marcos is very new to the U.S. because we lived in Los Angeles many, many years ago, and he was there. He was doing very well there. But Marcos is fantastic. For many, many years, he only played the piano. And in the last few years, I think that he's got the songbird
okay.
bug. And he has been singing a lot, and he has been taking vocal lessons for the last few years. And not only that, he's a very accomplished piano player. You know, his style is, he has some classical background, which brings him into the choro music of Brazil, which is very classical oriented. However, it grooves like Brazilian samba.
Okay.
You know, it's very, very interesting.
And then the name of that again was?
Choro. Chorinho. We call it chorinho. Yeah. So, you know, and Marcos is a fabulous entertainer. You know, he is very engaging. He always engages the audiences. It's a lot of fun. His shows are a lot of fun and educational, by the way.
So I'd like to ask you about the concept of a house concert mm-hmm. and the intimacy.
Yes, I have been hosting them for a while.
Okay.
Some are a little more intimate than others. But I have had Diego Figueiredo perform, Kenny Werner and Joyce Moreno performed. I have had several musicians that will be passing through town.
Right.
And it's an opportunity if I know that they don't have a large audience that would require me to rent a theater or what have you, you know, because they wouldn't probably accommodate that. So the house concert is a wonderful alternative to that. And it's a wonderful way for people to get to know the artist because it is so intimate.
And you can really feel the cultural impact of music from another part of the world when you're sitting in an intimate setting like that, I would imagine.
Oh, absolutely. And all the artists that I have hosted so far, they all have a great deal of passion for the music, and they absolutely love sharing, you know, with the audience. So it's always a great meet and greet event. We usually have a little Brazilian food or, you know, some appetizers, just light stuff, but just to give it a Brazilian flair to it.
Why not? It's a chance to pretty
Absolutely.
Much immerse yourself in Brazilian culture for
Indeed.
A little while and have the music be the vehicle that gets you there.
Indeed. It's very intimate. It's very nice. The venue is okay. This is it's a new venue for us in the sense that we just moved into this house maybe 2 years ago, but it's interesting. It's been very nice so far.
Okay, it's Sunday the 14th?
Sunday the 14th at 5 p.m.
Well, Kenya, thank you very much for coming in and talking about this interesting concept of a house concert. Again, it's with Marcos Ariel, and it's the 14th of July at 5 o'clock. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. Thanks a lot, Bob.
That was 90.5 WESA's Bob Studebaker speaking with Kenya about the latest in her series of house concerts happening this Sunday with pianist and composer Marcos Ariel. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. There was a ceremonial signing in Harrisburg yesterday of legislation intended to encourage more students to report sexual violence on college campuses. We're joined on the line by Tracy Vitchers, executive director of It's On Us, the national nonprofit championed by then Vice President Joe Biden in 2014. Tracy, thanks so much for making the time.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
You spoke at yesterday's bill signing when the governor said Pennsylvania now leads the nation in combating campus assault. Were the comments by the governor an exaggeration?
I would not say so. Pennsylvania has really taken up the banner of It's On Us, as well as has taken incredible steps to combat sexual violence across the state, particularly within our K-12 and post-secondary institutions. Pennsylvania was the first state to become an It's On Us state in 2016. And over the last 3 years, they've given out almost $3 million in grants to colleges and universities across the Commonwealth to help them prevent sexual assault within their communities. No other state is doing a program like that right now, and they're really doing a ton of great work to make sure that our students are able to pursue their education free from violence.
It's been 5 years since It's On Us began. Have you noticed any change, any maybe increase in rates of reporting, or even a reduction in the number of incidents?
Absolutely. Students are much more aware of the issue when they come onto campus since It's On Us launched in 2014. We've really made a strong effort to raise awareness within college communities. We currently have over 250 It's On Us chapters across the country with a very strong cohort here in Pennsylvania because we are an It's On Us state. And we really have seen a lot of strides being made in increasing reporting. And increasing reporting of sexual assault is really critical in eventually stopping the incidents from occurring in the first place. We can't solve a problem if we don't know the scope of it. And by encouraging students to report either anonymously through online reporting systems or in person to their Title IX office, colleges across the country are in a much better position to actually step up and take targeted measures to prevent sexual violence.
How does a group like It's On Us attempt to track what isn't happening or being reported? How can you know the maybe unknown?
There are a lot of different efforts that take place to track underreporting. So one of the examples is campus climate surveys. Campus climate surveys are conducted typically by an institution or by an outside agency on the issue of campus sexual assault, and they're fully anonymous surveys that students are encouraged to participate in. And that information is then compared with actual reporting rates, either reports that have gone through the Title IX process that year, or again, reports that have gone through anonymous online reporting systems. And then schools are able to take a look at those numbers and better understand, are students actually reporting sexual assaults when they're taking place? If they're not, then they can really do a cultural analysis of their campus to understand why students aren't coming forward. Or if the numbers are lining up pretty closely, then it means that then the schools are doing really strong efforts and really strong programming to encourage students to report if sexual assault does occur. And I think, you know, one of the things that's really critical is with the Pennsylvania legislation that was passed yesterday, those two bills are only part of a larger It's On Us legislative package that we're hoping the other five bills are passed into law in the fall. And one of those bills would actually mandate campus climate surveys to take place in all Pennsylvania post-secondary institutions to ensure that schools are tracking in a meaningful way what sexual assaults are being reported or not through those anonymous surveys.
How have Education Secretary Betsy DeVos's efforts to roll back Obama administration guidance on Title IX funding, particularly around campus sexual assault and harassment charges, impacted the effort to get more victims to come forward?
It has definitely had a negative effect, which unfortunately I think is something that Secretary DeVos wants to see. The efforts that she's put forward through the notice and comment process and her proposed changes to Title IX that were put forward last winter will be devastating to campus safety, and they will be devastating to survivors on campus. The thought that students who experience sexual assault, you know, a block from campus from another student can't necessarily go forward through the Title IX process and will be forced to go to law enforcement is abhorrent. Students should not have to sit in class across from their rapist. They should be able to pursue accommodations that allow them to still continue their education. And unfortunately, the work that Secretary DeVos is trying to do will be deeply, deeply damaging to campus safety at large. Schools have been so incredibly proactive over the last few years since the Obama-Biden administration to develop new prevention programs, to strengthen their Title IX policies, to strengthen their investigative efforts and adjudication processes in ways that make sense for their campus community and overall enhance campus safety. What Secretary DeVos is proposing will take us back to the days when campus sexual assault was swept under the rug and survivors had no recourse to pursue justice for themselves within their educational institution. And really, we should be moving forward. In the Me Too era, we really need to be focusing on creating additional protections for survivors, creating safer campus communities. Young women in this country should not face a 1 in 5 chance of graduating having experienced sexual assault.
Very briefly, we have just a couple minutes left. One of the bills the governor signed requires post-secondary institutions, trade schools, colleges, offer online anonymous options for students to report. How will that help briefly?
That will help tremendously. Many students don't report their sexual assaults at all. Fewer than 10% of sexual assault survivors on college campuses report their assault to their schools if they're forced to go into an in-person reporting process, either to campus safety or Title IX. Allowing students to anonymously report that they've experienced sexual violence will give colleges a better scope of understanding what is happening on their campus, when sexual assaults are more likely to take place, if there are hot spots on campus where they may need to start doing more proactive prevention efforts or monitoring of cultural and social behavior that's happening in that part of campus. And it will really at least give survivors an opportunity to feel counted and to feel that their campus is then equipped with the information that they need to take action to prevent it from happening to someone else.
A final question. We have a minute left. So there are more reports filed. Are you concerned that we will learn that the number of assaults are actually worse than thought and they were just going unreported? Briefly, please.
I think that the more reports that come forward, the better equipped colleges are to actually begin to tackle this problem. Sexual violence can no longer live in the shadows of campus communities, and schools need the data that anonymous online reporting provides to actually take proactive measures to address this issue. So if we do see increased numbers, it only really means that students feel safer and in a better position to report anonymously, and at least then the schools have that data to take action.
Tracy Vitchers is the executive director of the national nonprofit It's On Us. Tracy, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time on The Confluence, 1 in 6 children in Pennsylvania is growing up in poverty. That's slightly better than the national average, but concentrated child poverty does not only affect individual families, but also a region. If you missed anything from today's program, or if you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence. or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Julia Zenkovich, Julia Maruka, and Hannah Gaskill. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.